I'm reading from A Gathering of Saints, a true story of money, murder, and deceit, by Robert Lindsay. We just covered the explosion that killed the man across the office in Salt Lake City, across the hall from the office of Janet McDermott, October 15, 1985, which is going to begin a horror story of stress that permeates the Mormon Church. While Janet McDermott was listening to Life Ebb from the young man who was lying face up on the sixth floor of the judge building, another woman was getting ready to take a walk on the other side of the Salt Lake Valley. Kathleen Webb Sheets. Kathy Sheets and her husband, James Gary Sheets, live with the two youngest of their four children. After they had become millionaires, Kathy and Gary Sheets could have afforded to move up the slopes to a grander house, as so many other Utahans did, to send a signal they had succeeded in a culture that very much revered success. But they were content to remain where they were, in their own Mormon ward, in the home they had worked and planned for together. In so many ways, Kathy and Gary Sheets had accomplished things she had never dreamed of, accumulating things she had never thought of wanting. In so many ways, their life had been a success, and not only because of Gary's success in business. They had been married, sealed for time and all eternity. None of this till death do us part bit. Sealed for time and all eternity. In the Salt Lake Temple the year after her graduation from the university. Then, as Gary established himself, applying the drive and energy that always amazed her and always made her proud, she worked as a teacher, then assumed the only role that she ever expected in life, her duty as wife, mother, homemaker. There were other reasons to be proud. The church had called Gary as a bishop. She had served as president of the Relief Society and the Primary Association. The church had given her everything she'd ever wanted from it and more. At 8:15 a.m. on October 15, 1985, as a man lay sprawled across the doorway to his office in downtown Salt Lake City, Kathy Sheets cleaned up a mess around her family's garbage cans left the night before for prowling dogs. She passed the small sign she had posted in her kitchen, quote, "Avenge yourself, live long enough to be a problem to your children," and drove out the driveway in her red Audi with license plates that read "Erp Bag," a word Kathy Sheets used to describe anything disagreeable, the comic origins of which were lost somewhere in family history. She went to a neighbor's home to pick up her walking partner, Faye Cotter. After the walk, she stopped at the drive-in window of her bank . Deposited $800 and told the teller how much enjoyment she was getting from her youngest granddaughter, Molly. At 9:45, she arrived home, parked the Audi in the driveway. A brown box was lying near the garage. She picked it up, tucked it under her arm, walked toward the house. She saw a copy of the Salt Lake Tribune on the ground, bent over to pick it up. At that moment, a neighbor, Jane Forsgren, was thinking about awakening her sons. She had let them sleep later than usual because the family had returned late the previous night from a Columbus Day outing. "My gosh," she told her husband, "that sounds like a sonic boom." They looked out the window but did not see anything out of the ordinary and decided to wake the kids. Stephanie St. James, another neighbor, also heard a sharp noise. She looked over toward Kathy Sheets' house and saw hundreds of leaves swirling in the air as if they'd been caught up in a whirlpool. When a friend arrived at her home for a visit an hour later, Kathy Sheets was lying on her back. Her green eyes glazed and half opened, staring blankly into the sun. The blast had torn open her stomach and chest, disemboweled her, removed parts of several fingers, and severed her left arm at the elbow, leaving her forearm connected to the rest of her body by only two scorched strands of cartilage. A jagged piece of wood from the garage roof was lying across her pink jumpsuit like a starched and weathered shroud, and on the ground all around her were the red, gold, and orange leaves of autumn. Fearing a madman was loose, hundreds of people in the Salt Lake Valley requested police protection on the afternoon of October 15, 1985. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
How many have read this book? You read it? One in here. If you get bored, we got work back there in the ETR room. Fearing a madman was loose, hundreds of people in the Salt Lake Valley requested police protection on the afternoon of October 15, 1985. Others fled the valley by plane or automobile. Telephone bomb threats to newspapers and police agencies and rumors of religious death squads added to a haunting sense of fear that gripped the community. As television cameras and news reporters circled them, police officials tried to restore calm. Quote, "We want to assure people we don't have a mad person on the street indiscriminately killing people," Police Chief Bud Willoughby said at a press conference. Quote, "These were highly sophisticated bombs used by assassins. Someone was brought in to kill these people." Salt Lake County Sheriff N.D. Pete Hayward, in whose jurisdiction the murder of Mrs. Sheets occurred, agreed, quote, "The way the bomb was made, the way it was handled and detonated, the individual had to be a professional." You get some of these books for the bookstore by Sunday. Go early so you beat all the other people buying them up. "Do you suspect the mafia?" Hayward was asked. "That's a strong possibility," he said. Agents of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms sent a report to Washington that the two bombings appear to be related. Both victims, ATF agents reported, were part of an investment firm in which investors had lost tens of millions of dollars, and the apparent motive for killing was revenge. By dawn the following day, the largest criminal investigation in the history of Utah had begun. Nevertheless, most residents of the valley had to resume the routine tasks of ordinary life. For Christine Hayes, that meant patrolling downtown streets in a Jeep and ticketing overtime parkers. For Brad Christensen, a red-haired student who at 23 was already energized with a sense of ambition and drive that seemed to propel a disproportionate number of people in his community, it meant restocking a new flower shop he had recently opened. Shortly after 2:30 p.m., Christine Hayes spun the Jeep around to make a U-turn on Main Street, two blocks north of Temple Square, the headquarters of the Mormon Church. In her rearview mirror, she saw a stocky, dark-haired man crossing the streets toward a blue sports car. Then, resumed her search. for chalk marks that incriminated overtime Parker's. As she did, she checked her rearview mirror again, and the image that was reflected in the glass astonished her. The man she had seen moments earlier was several feet off the ground, airborne and flying backward. It ain't funny. Just the description is. As he fell to the pavement, a clap of thunder rumbled down the narrow street, becoming louder and louder as it ricocheted between the concrete buildings on each side of the street. Brad Christensen had been standing across the street, hands on his hips, trying to catch his breath after walking up the hill when he saw the man unlock the blue Toyota. The florist had entered the intersection and was walking toward his delivery truck when the bomb exploded. As he spun around, chunks of chrome and upholstery erupted from the Toyota like flaming lava from a volcano. The roof of the car was gone, and above it, sheets of paper were circling in the air like a flock of seagulls. Christensen sprinted across the street. The man he had seen a few minutes earlier was a motionless heap. His face was blue. Blood was streaming from a large hole in his head. There was another large and bloody hole in his right knee. Several bones on his right hand were exposed and one finger was gone. He looked as if he were dead. As Christensen wondered what he should do to help him, the car exploded into a scorching inferno. Within an instant, the flames engulfed the car and pushed him away from the man on the ground. "Let's get him out of there," he said to two other pedestrians who ran up behind him. Braving the heat and flames, they lifted the man off the asphalt and carried him to a nearby lawn and loosened his tie and shirt. As they did, Brad Christensen saw something beneath the man's shirt that propelled him into action as if it had been a jolt of electricity. Christensen removed a vial of consecrated oil from his pocket, and while all three men laid their hands on the man, one of the pedestrians daubed oil on his forehead, and Christensen prayed, "I command you to live," he said, "I command you to live in the name of Jesus Christ." After a moment, the man started to move. Now, what's this all about? Of course, you don't care, do you? What was it he saw in the man's, or under the man's shirt? Huh? You don't care, do you? Why am I doing this? I admire the Mormons. The Catholics are the largest religious group in California, the largest populated state in this union. The Mormons are the second largest. They got to be doing something right, including the ability to keep the media off their asteroids. My complaints when the Pope was here was not anything that the Catholics did. It was the ignoring of the press, of the seamy side of the Catholic Church and its activity, and the adulation of the Pope and the unquestioning acceptance of the pomp and opulence, perks and accessories that went along with his trips. While they beat every Protestant preacher to death, if he even thinks about driving a Mercedes. I never saw so many limousines in one line in my life. I don't think that old Erpbag Achoff, or whatever his name is, Gorbachev, had that long a retinue of limousines. But a Protestant preacher can't do it. Hell, I've been doing it for years. I mean, let's be sure that we understand. You know, up there, yin-yang, with 75 limousines sideways. Well, I ain't like the rest of them. I deny you the opportunity to exercise contribution credit in your giving, which we are fully qualified to give. Just as a way of saying, fuddy-dud to you, government. We don't raise money for projects in order that by going from sympathy to sympathy, I keep something going that I can milk with expenses. I don't raise money for anything except my teaching. Including teaching on the sex habits of walruses and the abominable habits of leaf-cutting ants in Brazil. We don't give away things for a love gift. We don't sell things in the church to escape taxes. We create corporations that pay taxes. They sell them. I don't do anything these other TV evangelists do. I just have a sense of fairness about me. I don't like Jim Baker, don't like Jimmy Swaggart, don't like their taste in anything that I've seen them tasting. I think their greatest sin is just being low class. When they... At times, the only people on the face of the earth that have tempted me to complain because I'm not a Martian. But I believe in fairness. And my complaint was not with the Catholics' way of doing things. I admire them. It was with the media's way of doing things, of winking and blessing the Catholic Church for doing some of the same things on a grander scale than they beat a poor little Protestant preacher to death for who does it on a peanut scale. Now that Jim Baker's going to trial, I don't want to bore you with the Catholic record again from the murder of the Pope to the laundering of mafia money to La Papessa, who talks about how romantic it was with that skinny little sparrow of a holy-looking pope that she used to walk in the garden with. I don't bore you with that again. So we're going to talk about number two. Like Avis, when you're second, you try harder. The Mormon Church. Again, I'm not against the Mormons. I admire them for the way they do things. I'm just saying there's a much bigger story here. If the media want to pay attention to it, everything you find in the Jim Baker scandal is multiplied many times over here. If what he did 7 years ago must be now about 10, is news, this much bigger news. The final push began on the Nebraska plains on an April morning in 1847. William Clayton, a handsome Lancashire bookkeeper who had crossed the Atlantic in pursuit of salvation, recorded the composition of the party in his journal. 143 men and boys, 3 women, 2 children, 72 wagons, 93 horses, 52 mules, 60 6 oxen, 19 cows, and 17 dogs and chickens. They were, he recorded, 148 souls who have decided to go west of the mountains as pioneers to find a home where the saints can live in peace and enjoy the fruits of their labors, and where we shall not be under the dominion of Gentile governments, subject to the wrath of mobs, and where the standards of peace can be raised, the ensign to the nations reared, and the kingdom of God flourish until truth shall prevail. As they struggled down the canyons of the Wasatch Front, a dazzling and bleak panorama unfolded before them. It was a desert valley, barren of timber and dominated by a shimmering lake stretching north as far as they could see. "This is truly a wild-looking place," wrote Clayton. The journey to the Salt Lake Valley had begun 17 years earlier and almost 2,000 miles away on a farm in upstate New York. On April 6, 1830, six men led by a 24-year-old farmer's son named Joseph Smith, Jr., incorporated a new religious faith, the Church of Christ. In itself, the event was not extraordinary. In western New York, new churches were sprouting like birch trees and competing for disciples in a crowded forest of religious experimentation. From New England, the restless, the have-nots, the adventurous were moving west in search of land and a better life, while leaving behind, along with everything else, the austere faith and Puritan values of their past. This is going to be a much more interesting story than Jim Baker. And this John Wesley Fletcher guy. You cleanse your soul, friends, for free. Nobody ever can sit and say that they're trying to cleanse their soul and be honest when they get paid to do it. Just write that down as a rule of life. And Jessica Hahn says she gave $165,000 to PTL. Gave it back. If it were a preacher, the news media would be at his throat instantly, asking first for proof, and second, was it done voluntarily or under duress? And thirdly, where'd you get it? Well, they don't ask those questions of the accuser of a Protestant churchman. I don't like him. I accused him years ago myself, but nobody paid me to do it. Although the meeting in April 1830 at Fayette, New York farmhouse was not in itself extraordinary, the story told by their leader was, Joseph Smith, Jr. told his followers that in September 1823, an angel had visited him several times while he was working the fields near his home. The angel, whom Smith subsequently called Moroni, led him to a cache of gold tablets. He said the angel told him that he had buried the plates near Smith's home 1,400 years ago. He said they contained a written history of an ancient civilization that had once thrived in America but later came upon hard and turbulent times and vanished except for a handful of survivors who were the ancestors of the American Indians. Although the angel withheld the gold tablets from him, Moroni reappeared on the anniversary of their first meeting during each of the succeeding 3 years. Finally, Smith said that on September 22, 1827, the angel appeared again and granted him temporary possession of the plates, along with two magical stones called Urim and Thummim that Smith could use to translate the ancient people's language on the tablets into English. The treasure... You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
On the telephone. Finally, Smith said that on September 22, 1827, I'm reading from A Gathering of Saints, A True Story of Money, Murder, and Deceit by Robert Lindsay. The angel Moroni appeared again and granted him temporary possession of the golden plates, along with two magical stones called Urim and Thummim that Smith could use to translate the ancient people's language on the tablets into English. The treasure was buried in a small rounded hill, the hill Cumorah, that rose above the sparsely cultivated farmland 3 miles from Smith's log cabin. Joseph Smith said he then spent many months deciphering the plates, which he said had been written in reformed Egyptian characters in the alphabet of an ancient language that, according to Moroni, had been handed down and altered by us according to our manner of speech. The story Smith described was essentially a history of the American Indians that he said was written by prophets and divided into books. It recounted how a band of Hebrews, led by a great prophet named Lehi, had abandoned Jerusalem 600 years before the birth of Christ. About the time of Jeremiah, because of its wickedness, and migrated by boat to the Americas. In the New World, Lehi's family split into two warring factions, the way the Israelites always acted. One, a mostly righteous group, was led by his son Nephi. The other, a wicked faction, was led by his son Laman. Because of their sins, God cursed the followers of Laman and gave them dark skin. Red. Of course, Joseph Smith got around, and the Mormons got around, to condemning blacks as the mark put on Cain. God just seemed to not like black. I don't like black Santa Clauses because Santa Claus was never black. But I don't like the Bible being distorted as though the mark put on Cain was black, when in fact archaeological research through the Celtic Cauldron indicates that the mark was white. And it was the white matriarch, married to Noah of the line of Cain, on the Celtic Cauldron that confirms that. So there's more evidence. Noah had Mongolian-like characteristics. So the evidence suggests the mark of Cain was white, not the other way around. That the antediluvian patriarchs were more black and the exception to the rule was white. Put that in your theological pipe and smoke it. But according to Moroni, God cursed Laman. God gets mad at people, he makes them black and blue. Smith said the record he translated described centuries of warfare between the Nephites and the Lamanites that was unremitting except for a period of 200 years or so following the resurrection of Jesus, when he, Jesus, came to the New World, visited Lehi's descendants, delivered a discourse similar to the Sermon on the Mount, and directed them to preach his gospel. Later, hostilities erupted again. All God's children fight ever so often. Later, hostilities erupted again until a climatic battle in A.D. 421 near the hill Cumorah that ended with a conquest of the Nephites, the good guys, but the Lamanites, the bad guys. The Nephites' only survivor was Moroni. He's the only one who buried in the hill plates containing a history of their civilization recorded by his father, a prophet named Mormon. The Lamanites survived, but because they kept no written history or genealogical records, time washed away all memories of their Hebrew origins, and they became the progenitors of the aboriginal Indians Columbus found when he arrived in the New World. Wasn't anybody left but Moroni of the others. Joseph Smith entitled the book he translated, The Book of Mormon, after the prophet named Mormon, father of Moroni. In 1827, I'm born here.
No, sir.
Martin Harris, a farmer and wealthy neighbor of Smith's, was impressed by his story of finding a gold Bible and gave him $50 to feed his family while he completed his translation. In February of the following year, Harris decided to travel to New York City to consult experts about the exciting and mysterious discovery. He took with him a sheet of paper upon which Smith said he had copied a few of the characters from the gold plates and showed them to Charles Anthon, a Columbia College classic scholar. When Harris returned to Palmyra, the village in western New York where he lived, he reported that Anthon said they were similar to Egyptian hieroglyphics or Arabic symbols, but that he had been unable to decipher them. Obviously. The work growing out of the Rosetta Stone and Champollion's work, and the expansion of knowledge about hieroglyphics was still forming. Nor could Dr. Samuel Mitchell, a physician and vice president of Rutgers University, translate him. Smith said it didn't surprise him that the two scholars could not translate the hieroglyphics. The prophet Isaiah had predicted 25 centuries before that in time a great book would be brought forth and delivered to one that is learned, saying, "Read this, I pray thee," and he saith, "I cannot, for it's sealed." That's what it says to Isaiah. Harris became Smith's first disciple and transcribed the words of the Book of Mormon as Smith translated them. Smith placed the two special stones, Urim and Thummim, into his hat, buried his face in the hat, and then shrouded under a blanket, dictated to Harris the writings that he said were on the gold plates. I'm getting too hot in here. To impress his family, am I boring you?
No.
To impress his family with the importance of his holy work, Martin Harris took home the first 116 pages that Smith had translated and had called the Book of Lehi. The pages were never seen again. Their fate obscured by time and conflicting legends. According to one legend, Harris's wife, Lucy, was so outraged when he told her that he wanted to give Smith more money that she burned the manuscript. Others said religious rivals of Smith stole the Book of Lehi. Still others said Harris simply lost the 116 pages out of carelessness. Whatever the answer, the fate of the first 116 pages of the Book of Mormon would remain a mystery that endured long after Martin Harris died in 1875. Joseph Smith said that when he had finished translating the gold plates, the angel Moroni took them away from him on March 26, 1830. 5,000 copies of the Book of Mormon minus the Book of Lehi were published in Palmyra by a local printer, Egbert B. Grondon, financed by a $3,000 mortgage on Harris's 240-acre farm. Because few copies were sold, Harris was unable to pay his debt and lost his farm. Almost from the day it was published, the Book of Mormon came under attack and ridicule. Neighbors of Smith claimed that it was a figment of his imagination, that he initially told them it was a novel he had written in order to ease his family's poverty, and that he had been surprised when some people regarded it not only as truthful but as divine scripture. As word of Smith's gold Bible spread over western New York, its dramatic account of bloody warfare, family intrigue, and a daring flight across the seas, together with an optimistic spiritual message that promised true believers riches and a good life, began to attract disciples to the church that Smith and his friends had organized. The book provided what to many frontiersmen sounded like a plausible explanation for the origins of the Indians, still very much a presence on the frontier. Once a potential convert accepted the Book of Mormon as truthful, it was only a short step to acceptance of a claim by Joseph Smith that his church was, quote, the only true and living church upon the face of the whole earth. That's what the Catholic Church claims. Seems like success in religion requires that kind of exclusivity. We may be the only true and living church upon the face of the whole earth whose members use their brains. To those who accepted the Book of Mormon, the message was clear. God had sent a Latter-day prophet, Joseph Smith, Jr., to reestablish his Old Testament church, and those who followed him were an elite people whose help God would need to prepare earth for the second coming of Christ when he would rule 1,000 years of light and holiness. During this imminent millennium, Smith preached God would turn the members of his only true church to rule his earthly principalities. That's all good, solid, traditional Christianity, just claimed exclusively now for the Mormons. The Mormonites, as they were first called on the frontier, were God's chosen people, the sons and daughters of Israel. Only they had covenant with God. Only they were the Lord's elect. Despite little education and humble beginnings, Smith proved to be an articulate, charismatic leader. Soon people began to flock around him. Tall, well-built, and handsome, brimming with intelligence and self-confidence, he had a thick head of black hair brushed back from his forehead and a powerful voice that well equipped him for his role as a modern Moses. To distinguish his church from sects with similar names, Smith changed his name to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Those who obeyed God's original gospel in the last days before the millennium were the saints of the latter days. Everyone else was Gentile. In a country whose religious experience had been shaped by a Calvinist vision of a vengeful God convinced of man's inherent evil, determined to make him atone for Adam's original sin, and menacing him with visions of a fiery hell, Smith broke the tether to Calvinism and seldom mentioned hell. He said man alone by his good works determined his fate after death, and in a new country where young people were taught that anyone could aspire to become president, Joseph Smith said any man could become a god. That's one up in them, I'll tell you. I like their style. I'm not critical of Mormons at all, man. I like their style. After examining scrolls of papyrus found buried with an Egyptian museum money, Smith said that they were the lost writings of the Old Testament prophet Abraham that gave him new insight into God's blueprint for the universe. He said he had translated the papyri just as he had translated the gold plates and determined that man's life on earth was only one step in a long progression leading up to his deification. He said there was not one God in the universe, he said, but many. Every man was a God in embryo. Every man could rule his own planet as God ruled earth. Indeed, God himself was once as we are now, a man with flesh and bones. Now he is an exalted man, sits enthroned in yonder heavens. Smith said, I want you to listen to all this, which is basic, foundational Mormon truths by their founder. You know, it's like the news media stands in awe, never inquires at all about the Mass when the Pope conducts it, and their absolute belief that when he speaks, that flesh, that bread and that wine literally becomes the flesh and blood of Christ. The authoritarian exclusiveness that the Pope is the vicar of Christ and the church that he commands with absolute authority, an infallible expression of truth when he speaks for the church, views itself as the sole custodian of truth and that which is right on this earth. Everything else is relatively inferior. You don't find the media belittling them at all. But they belittle every utterance of faith by a simple Protestant preacher. They would have every Protestant preacher take care of the homeless and feed the poor and live out of the sack in Skid Row to identify with the poor. You don't hear them taking on the Mormon church, who preaches the doctrine every man was a god in embryo. Indeed, God himself was once as we are, a man with flesh and bones. Now he's exalted man, sits enthroned in yonder heavens. Smith said God revealed to him the plan by which men could become gods. Before birth, every human existed in a pre-mortal state known as spirit child. Mortal men and women were obligated to liberate these spirits by conceiving children. At the close of their earthly lives, each spirit would await the millennium, when families would be reunited, marriages were to be for time and all eternity, not until death doth you part. Families, like life itself, were to last into eternity. In temple rituals, children were to be sealed to their parents, assuring they would rejoin them in eternity. When Jesus returned, Mormons who had led worthy lives would be risen from the dead, and joined with their spirits, and would enter the kingdom of God, an exalted place with three levels, each offering more glory and privilege than the one below it. Those judged to have led the worthiest lives would be admitted to the loftiest tier of the celestial kingdom, be reunited with their families, and ultimately become gods like Jesus, each a ruler of his own star, planet, and principalities. Not all of that is wrong, but it's got few twists of its own. As the church attracted more members, its claim to being God's only true church and whispers that it purported to turn men into gods brought it under increasing attack from members of other faith. Criticism soon turned to harassment on the frontier and then often to vicious mob attacks. Less than a year after the church was organized, Joseph Smith said he had received a divine revelation directing that there should be a gathering of the Lord's elect. At their gathering place, Joseph Smith said members of the elect could live together in peace, isolated from their persecutors in the Gentile world, share their wealth, and await the millennium, preparing as God's acolytes to bring godliness to a chaotic world. Abandoning New York, Joseph Smith led the saints to Ohio, then Missouri, then Illinois in search of a gathering place. Mobs, increasingly propelled as much by fear of economic and political competition from the close-knit Mormons as by their doctrines, pursued them wherever they went. The blood of hundreds of Mormons and that of their enemies moistened the plains as they moved westward. There was also bloody strife in the Mormon camp, often stirred by rebellion over Smith's authoritarian rule. John Wesley Fletcher went on TV to complain about... Don't lose the purpose for which I'm doing this. To smother dissent, some saints close to the prophet formed a secret society called the Danites to execute in the name of the Lord those who challenged him. Hostility, persecution, and internal strife only seemed to push Smith harder to build his church. And as his flock expanded on the American frontier, he sent missionaries abroad to begin the task of bringing the restored gospel to the rest of the world. Declaring that he received revelations directly from God and was God's surrogate on earth, Another word for vicar. Smith promulgated new doctrines and secret rituals adapted from those of the Masonic Lodge. He disclosed that when he was 14, he'd been visited by God the Father and Jesus, who came to him in a pillar of light. And that later John the Baptist had come to him on earth and personally ordained him a priest. You won't find the news media ridiculing any of these things or bringing a Mormon bishop forward. I mean, after all, the second largest religious group in California. This is their founder speaking. Not me, what I'm reading here. And I'm not against the Mormons. I admire them. All I'm saying is, what's fair is fair. As his missionaries began to send converts across the Atlantic to join him, Smith found the Zion for which he'd been searching. In 1840, the Illinois legislature allowed him to build a settlement near a small town called Commerce at the western edge of the state. That Smith renamed Nauvoo. It was a Hebrew word meaning beautiful plantation. Before long, Nauvoo was a thriving community on the Mississippi that each month welcomed hundreds of new converts. Within a year, the church claimed a membership of more than 20,000, and Nauvoo was the largest city in Illinois. The happiness, however, was brief. Smith had long had a reputation for possessing a physical as well as a spiritual interest in women other than his wife, Emma. Many Mormon women responded to the handsome prophet with the booming voice and stirring gift of persuasion. In 1842, Smith promulgated a secret new principle of Mormonism. I know that I am not religious because I'm a historian. I'm an undergraduate major in history. And the way the religion and sex have gone hand in hand together down through the ages, the lack of one is proof positive of the lack of the other. You figure out which one, like chicken and the egg. In 1842, Smith promulgated a secret new principle of Mormonism, one he had personally been practicing for several years, called celestial marriage. Other people called it polygamy. Every man, Smith said, an absolute unbeatable way to increase the membership. I'm telling you, folks, if I had a desire to be phony, it's amazing the way in which certain revelations can immediately cause growth in the church. If... Every man, hang on now. Every man, hold it. Old something. Every man, Smith said, had a right to marry 10 virgins. There ain't any church in the world that won't grow with that concept. At least the male membership of the church will grow, I'll tell you that for sure. Many...